Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
And I'm Ayan Bior, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, January 15th, 2016. Women outlined why the next Speaker of Parliament should be a woman.
I want to see a woman that give a portfolio of the work in the ministry and to fulfill it and do it according to the needs of the people of South Sudan. A person that putting her party back, her people first, and party be the second.
And South Sudan's government says it's working to reduce the number of children out of school.
There's a commitment of the government to put more funds in education. And also, another strategy is to mobilize the communities in terms of local contribution. Because if you think of funding to build a classroom, you need to involve the people.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese women who petitioned President Salva Kiir to appoint a female speaker for parliament in the upcoming transitional government of national unity believe service delivery would improve under a female leader. Philip Thonaleo has more for VOA from Juba.
Women's rights activist Helen Daniel says there should not only be a female speaker, but women should be appointed to many positions of power.
Since we got independence as South Sudan, we don't feel free because only men are working and they don't care about women. We are educated. We studied up to university, but nobody cares about us. If there is a woman in authority, she will say, bring Helen to be a minister and I will be comfortable and there will be no more children on the streets.
Daniel is one of about 100 women who gathered at the Women's Union office in Juba yesterday to read aloud a petition sent to President Salva Kiir asking that he appoint a female parliamentary speaker. She says women must be part of the new pace of South Sudan.
We want women like us to be brought to leadership because we know the suffering we are going through. We know everything. We can make a difference in this country. But those women who travel in cars only know their families, and they go for medical checkups in Nairobi in America, just moving up and down without taking care of the people.
Sarah Jacob, who works in the Women Union office of the former Central Equatorial State, agrees. Jacob says the women appointees should be women who have not held government jobs in the past.
I want to see a woman that give a portfolio of the work in the ministry and to fulfill it and do it according to the needs of the people of South Sudan. This is a kind of woman that I want to see, capable person, a person that putting her party back, her people first, and party be the second.
Jacob says, besides upholding the laws for abused women and girls, there are many other pressing issues which the transitional government of national unity need to address, such as providing clean drinking water to all citizens.
We are getting dirty water, and this dirty water we are paying very expensive, which other people cannot even afford to pay this dirty water that we are getting, and we are buying diseases for ourselves, and we are having river flowing near us, and this river we are paying a lot of money for this dirty water.
Jacob says children are dying because they don't have clean drinking water. Most Juba residents buy water from vendors who use tanks to collect it from River Nile. Cases of cholera and other waterborne diseases are commonplace in South Sudan. Activist Dorcas Francis says a female speaker of parliament should immediately address challenges facing girls and young mothers.
This time we need to see changes because there is enough abuse that is occurring to women and nothing has been done about it. There is a rape, sexual abuse, domestic violence, but nothing is done about it. There is still the percentage is still outside there as it is before. Therefore, we need this time for a speaker to be a woman because we are quite sure women will make a change this time.
Daniel admits it will be an uphill battle to select a woman from the rural area to the Speaker of National Parliament. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Juba.
A Ministry of Education official says the government will work with aid agencies to reduce the extremely high number of children not attending school in South Sudan. A report released earlier this week by the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says South Sudan is home to the highest proportion of out-of-school children, with more than half of primary and lower secondary age children not receiving an education. As Megumi Davis-Rakowinj reports from Juba, a lack of funding and insecurity both contribute to South Sudan's top ranking on UNICEF's list of out-of-school children in conflict zones.
Lopuke Lotiam, Undersecretary of the Ministry of Education, says children's education in South Sudan was bad even before the conflict broke out in late 2013. Lotiam says the government is planning to increase the education budget to help rehabilitate schools destroyed by the 2 years of fighting.
There is a commitment of the government to create, to put more funds in education. And also, another strategy is to mobilize the communities in terms of local contribution. Because if you think of funding to build a classroom, you need to involve the people. You need to ask the people their contribution, whatever they can.
Only 6% of South Sudan's budget is allocated to education. The Ministry of Education uses much of that money to pay the salaries of officials. The UNICEF report says a severe lack of funding is to blame for the high school dropout rate and the woefully inadequate number of qualified teachers in South Sudan. Lotiam says even before the conflict began, the government was aware of the problem. UNICEF's education officer for South Sudan, Fun Nguyen, says the conflict in Unity, Lakes and Jonglei states has affected many children.
We find that due to the fact that schools were closed, schools were occupied by armed groups, schools were closed because of the lack of operational maintenance and budget, schools were destroyed, destructed, occupied also by not only armed groups but also by IDPs. All of these reasons contributed to the number of children who had to drop out. And of course, poverty.
Wynne says poverty is a huge problem in South Sudan. Between 2013 and 2015, Wynne says more than 800 schools were destroyed. Wynne says the government and other aid agencies must make education a top priority. She says attending school not only prevents children from becoming fighters for various militia groups in the country, but allows them to learn life skills.
Life skills against protection against gender violence, how to wash hands, how to maintain their health, how to avoid mine risk, and so forth. So not only do children have a sense of normalcy when they go to school, but also the fact that the environment itself is protecting them from safety, from harm. So they are much safer in the classroom than not, especially adolescent boys and girls, adolescent boys who may be recruited into armed groups and armed forces.
Lopuke Lotiam says with the help of the United States Agency for International Development, his ministry was able to construct 350 learning centers for 400,000 children across the country. Care International, Save the Children, Oxfam and other international agencies are working with the Ministry of Education to give South Sudanese children an opportunity to go back to school after facing years of violence across the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
The task of fully implementing the August peace agreement between South Sudan's warring parties has been assigned to former Botswana President Festus Mahai. He is the chairman of South Sudan's Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body tasked with ushering in stability in a country that has been embroiled in conflict for the past 2 years. We thought it would be interesting to know more about the 76-year-old father of three, who has been characterized as one of Africa's success stories. Wilson Center fellow Steve McDonald is a former colleague of President Mahai's. The two have been friends since 1992. McDonald says he was impressed by Mahai's work ethic and dedication.
Absolutely trustworthy, absolutely responsible and accountable, and a man who has a remarkable sense of leadership and connection with people.
Mahai earned a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Oxford in the UK. He then went on to earn a master's in development economics from the University of Sussex, also in England. Mahai has been honored with several awards, including the Grand Cross of France's Légion d'Honneur, the Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership, and the Africa America Institute's National Leadership Award, which was also awarded to Nelson Mandela. He is a busy man. Mahai currently chairs Champions for an HIV-Free Generation, an initiative led by former African heads of states and prominent African leaders to end the spread of AIDS in Africa. In 2008, Mahai was appointed by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon as Special Envoy on Climate Change, a title he currently holds and shares with three other individuals. In 1976, Mahai went to work with the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., as an alternate executive and then executive director for Anglophone Africa. He later returned home, where he was eventually appointed as vice president of Botswana from 1992 to 1998. He then became the third president of Botswana when he was elected in 1998 and re-elected in 2004 for his second five-year term. Botswana has been hailed as one of the biggest success stories in Africa. A World Bank report found poverty in Botswana declined from 31% to 19% between 2002 and 2010, particularly in rural areas, as a result of increased labor and agriculture-related incomes and more opportunities for the poor. The decline represented 180,000 people who were pulled out of poverty. 87% of them lived in rural areas, according to the report. The World Bank, however, cautioned significant pockets of poverty remain in significant decline. Many of Botswana's poor are children under 15 years old, according to the World Bank's December 2015 figures. Education spending in Botswana is among the highest in the world. According to the World Bank, who estimates around 9% of GDP is spent on educating Botswana, which includes the provision of nearly universal and free primary education. When he was re-elected as president in 2004, he sought to fight the spread of HIV/AIDS in Botswana, which was crippling the country with one of the highest HIV infection rates in the world. McDonald says Mahai's approach to ending the spread of HIV in his country was understanding the issue and knowing how its citizens would react to it. He says he was also effective in using national and international resources to tackle the issue.
He was unlike many other African leaders at that point in time, who sort of said, you know, HIV/AIDS is something that is not inherent to us, that it's kind of a Western myth that we are not necessarily responsible for this. He took the responsibility. He moved forward in trying to work with the population and committing his own resources, I mean, resources of course the government, as well as international aid, to look at both the issues of treatment of AIDS and of changing the culture around which AIDS was, becoming such a terrible problem.
The prevalence of AIDS among people in Botswana aged 15 to 49 is 25.2%, according to UNAIDS. The goal is to reach 1% prevalence rate. 5,100 people died of AIDS in Botswana in 2014. McDonald says that Mahai's style of leadership is connecting one-on-one with the people. Radio Tamazi reports Mahai is on a tour in South Sudan, where he has visited Malakal and Bentiu, two heavily affected areas. The protection of civilian site in Bentiu is the largest in the country. The aim of the visits, according to Radio Tamazu, is to meet people predominantly affected by the conflict and to hold meetings with the leaders of each town.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The new governor of Wau State says more tribes should be recognized in South Sudan. That story when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you prefer hot drinks or cold drinks?
I prefer cold drinks. I don't like hot things. So I drink majorly, especially water and other things, generally because I want to suit my heart.
I take both hot and cold. It's nature. It's what keeps your body and soul fine. You take it. If it's not good for your system, of course you abstain from it.
I prefer hot drinks. I'm not a fan of cold drinks because it normally affects the teeth sometimes when it's too cold, and then some of the cold drinks are refined. I'm avoiding it, and they make one gain a lot of weight.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. New Wau State Governor Elias Waya Niapuch wants the Falata nomadic community, which comes from Nigeria but spends several months a year grazing their cattle in his state, to be recognized as South Sudanese tribes. He wants other tribes who are doing the same thing to be considered South Sudanese citizens as well. Communities in Wau have mixed reactions to the governor's suggestions. Michael Atit has the story for VOA from Wau.
Governor Elias Waya Niapuch's suggestions that the Falata and those known as Greeks, because of their forefathers came from Greece, says the two communities deserve South Sudanese citizenship since their ancestors were born in South Sudan in the 19th century. Waya says he and many other leaders were taught by Falata teachers in Wau, and many of them have contributed to the development of this country in other ways. He says the Falata and Greek communities should be added to the list of 64 South Sudanese tribes.
They were born and raised up here with us, and now they have members in the National and State Assembly, but they are not counted among the 64 tribes. We have inherited the old Sudan with these entire groups, and now we are an independent country as South Sudan, so no one should be excluded from those tribes.
The Falata and Greek communities welcome the governor's suggestion, saying it will provide them with more opportunities. Yeni Mastrolis was born of a South Sudanese mother and a Greek father in Wau 60 years ago. He says his wife is from Wau, so he and his five kids are automatically South Sudanese by nationality.
We are South Sudanese because we were born from South Sudanese mothers. We know our fathers are from Greece, but they married from here, and we also married from here, and we produced children from here. Now we are citizens of South Sudan, so we are happy to hear from a top government official that we are a part of this country.
Yeni says, though Greeks came to South Sudan back in the early 19th century as traders and businessmen, members of his community often face several challenges while applying for national documents such as nationality identity card or passport. He says he tried several times to acquire a nationality card, but has yet to be issued one. 63-year-old Ali Ahmad is from the Falata community. He says his grandfather came to South Sudan from Nigeria several decades ago while going to Mecca in Saudi Arabia.
The Falata have intermarried with local communities like Zanda, Golo, Ndogo, and even Jur. And now our kids are big people, and they are holding major positions in the government.
Ahmad says it would be difficult for Falata descendants like him to return to their ancestors' homeland in Nigeria because no one knows them there. Another Falata man, Shuaib Muhammad, says if they are recognized as South Sudanese nationals, they can access opportunities and services like all other citizens. Muhammad, who has been a chief in Wau since 1983, says members of his communities are committed to developing South Sudan.
We are all one, and we don't need more segregation among communities. Let's all work for the development of this country. We are all South Sudanese.
50-year-old Elizabeth Bernardo Mboro, a mother of five, comes from South Sudan's Ndogo tribe and is married to a man of Greek origin. Mboro says she supports the idea of adding the Falata and the Greeks to the list of South Sudanese tribes, saying such a decision is long overdue.
These people are born here and they have intermarried with the locals. Why are they denied the nationality? I am upset that my children and I faced several questions at the migration office.
Article 45, sub-article 1 of the 2011 South Sudan Transitional Constitution states that every person born to a South Sudanese mother or father shall have an inalienable right to enjoy South Sudanese citizenship and nationality. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
The leader of Sudan's opposition National Umma Party blames Khartoum for its failure to act after a pre-dialogue meeting that was held with opposition officials. They warn they will launch a new campaign to isolate the government. VOA fellow Khaltuma Vanessa has this report.
At a news conference 2 days ago in Sudan's Omdurman's, the party leader said the government continues to reject opposition groups' participation in a meeting for national dialogue that the African Union plans to hold in Addis Ababa. Nama Al-Mahdi, one of the executives in the Umma Party, who is based in London, says President Omar al-Bashir's government is not serious about finding any solution to the inadequate condition faced by millions of Sudanese every day, including fighting that continues in parts of the country and Sudan's poor economy. She says the much talked about national dialogue is merely an exercise in government pride to appeal to Western forces and to attract funding for the country.
The government has not built confidence amongst the political parties or among the Sudanese people to actually show that they're serious about the national dialogue. I mean, the national dialogue should be part of a democratic process.
Al-Mahdi says the national dialogue lacks goals for inclusion of opposition parties and clear objectives for gathering consensus.
The idea of the national dialogue as a way out and the roundtable talks was actually proposed by the Umma party. The way it's been conducted is not the way it was proposed. I mean, we're talking what the government is calling for are the initial phases. They're calling for participation in the initial phases of the dialogue, which has been ongoing for 2 years.
She says the party signed an agreement months ago with other opposition parties and the Sudan's revolution forces. She says the Umma party wants to rebuild the Sudanese states.
To the process of building and developing a broad political and social front based on a strong Sudan, working to develop and implement a program and a roadmap to include new constitutional arrangements implemented during an agreed upon transitional period and working towards state building based on the framework of human rights.
Al-Mahdi says the agreement calls for a platform of human rights and the start of the restoration of the Sudanese states. The National Umma Party Secretary General Sara Nudala says the new campaign of the party is in line with several mobilization campaigns the party organized in support of peace and democracy, which include isolating the regime and paving the way for a popular uprising. For VOA News, I am Khaltuma Vanessa in Washington.
Elderly people in Cameroon complain that they are increasingly being abandoned by society, even when they have diseases that often come with old age. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé that the country is gradually leaving behind its tradition of at-home elderly care, instead creating a growing number of centers for elderly persons.
72-year-old Ngai Giselle has been at Yaoundé's Bethany Viacam Center for Old, Invalid and Abandoned Persons for 4 years. She says she was abandoned by her family and 2 kids who, according to cultural tradition, are supposed to take care of her. Giselle says a kind stranger brought her here when she started suffering from chronic heart infections.
La famille, c'est là où Dieu te met, c'est là la famille. En venant ici, c'est un papa Jésus.
She says when she recovered from unconsciousness, she was told a Jesuit priest called Roger brought her to the center. She says she believes she is still living thanks to God's love and the family-like love she was given at the center. The center is home to 45 elderly persons. 84-year-old former teacher Jean Etundi says his daughter brought him to the center because her busy career made it impossible to take care of him.
C'est ma fille qui m'a amené ici parce que je suis paralytique. Ma fille, elle travaille Douala.
He says his daughter got a job in Cameroon's economic capital Douala and could no longer live with him. He says his daughter now sends money to treat his paralysis. Njula Pascaline, an official of the center, says it was once a social taboo in Cameroon for people to take their old parents to assisted living homes. But because of low incomes or disinterest, many people are now disregarding the old tradition.
Lorsque vous avez une personne âgée dans votre famille, elle devient une charge pour vous.
She says elderly persons become a burden on the family, and that since most youth are in search of jobs in the cities, they have no option other than to abandon their old parents in villages or in homes for the elderly. She says another group of elderly people who are abandoned are those who are accused of witchcraft practices. A 2013 study by the Central African Economic Commission and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights found that just 10% of Cameroon's people have social insurance plans that help take care of them in their old age. Richard Ndintanto, director of the non-governmental organization Ecumenical Service for Peace, piloted the study. He says it is imperative for the government to take care of the needs of the elderly.
Well, we are going to engage stakeholders with this study so that they see exactly what is happening with the elderly around Africa, so that at least we should begin to reflect on how we can set up a system which would be able to rehabilitate elderly persons. There are people who spend their lives working to build a country, and I don't think it is good for the country to abandon them when they are at old age.
Some of the elderly in Cameroon say they never had sufficient means to prepare for retirement and old age, especially after Cameroon's currency suffered a 50% devaluation in 1994 and state workers saw their salaries cut by 60%. Social worker Mbibe Roslin says such conditions made it difficult for many people to prepare for retirement.
When they leave work and they go back to the village, they don't have what to take care of themselves, especially those who did not prepare towards their old age. So we're trying to see how we make a society that is inclusive, that will make everybody feel comfortable.
The United Nations Population Division estimates that by 2050, the number of people worldwide aged 60 and over will increase to 2 billion because of improved health care. 80% of them will be living in developing countries. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Stand Up by Bob Marley.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Yeah.
We've been listening to Bob Marley and the Wailers with the song Get Up, Stand Up. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
And I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.